Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, you beautiful citizens of the internet.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, gang, it's me, and I'm back.
Gentlemen, I have a whole show planned out, but first, you know what time it is?
It's
Sunday?
Night Attack Name Chant Corner Hour.
No. Time for Yeti News.
Whoa, thank goodness.
Oh, damn. We have not gone into the Yeti well for a while.
It's time for some Yeti News. What would be better than just me telling you an account of a Yeti? How about Russian dash cam footage of a Yeti?
Oh, my gosh. Are you saying that there's such a thing as Yeti images and that we could license the photos from Yeti images?
We got the proof now, skeptics. I have not watched this, so Bryce, if you can pull up Yeti dash cam, I can email it to you, but you're usually faster at finding
this
stuff.
He's already got it, dude. He's got wizard fingers. Play?
Here, Bryce, pause it for a second. This is a 1 minute, 40 second video. For those of you who are not aware, obviously the dash cam culture in Russia is ubiquitous because insurance scams are such a pervasive thing. So the idea that dash cams catch everything in Russia is not necessarily the kind of thing that it would be here in the States, where you'd be like, I don't know, is this legitimate, right? Like there's an air. We trust Russian dash cam videos, I think, more than we would in other countries. Is that
mainly because, like, if you pull out a cell phone or if you pull out a film camera back in the day, you're doing so with the intent to record something through the lens of your experience, whereas dash cams are just always on. So oftentimes, like, some of the best reactions to that asteroid, crashing into that city are all super authentic.
All right. So here, let's go ahead and take a look here. Yeti dash cam video, a snowy road.
Yeah, lots of snow, a little bit of droplets on the windshield.
I'd say you can see is the road.
2 foot snowbanks on each side. The road's not visible because there's snowpack all the way along, and it's black outside of. You see just the road and the vegetation to each side.
I'm already terrified. So,
yeah,
and he's going maybe what, 25 miles an hour, 20, 25?
Yeah, he's cautiously navigating.
And it's very, very light snows. It's got that, star effect, basically, like you picture in space. Whoa, 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 whoa! Okay.
Boom.
Okay.
We decide.
It is
the L.
Definitely a brown covered bipedal entity.
There's a word on the tip of my tongue. Begins with E, ends in K.
Yes.
Eric, my brother?
It does look like
about the same height.
It does look like an Ewok. It looks like a small kid.
Yeah, it only looks like 3 or 4 feet tall.
Well, what's hard to understand is just the distance, right? Like, because we're making these assumptions about how high the snowbanks are and everything, but all right, so it looks like it is running, right? That's what makes it look markedly.
And you can see the snow get kicked up as it's running. Like, this is not like a. One of the best stories I ever heard as a kid was when I was in eighth grade, my physical science teacher talked to me about the time he was out in West Texas in the middle of the night. And as he drove, getting highway hypnosis, he saw the visage of a 3.5 foot tall kid with his head down, just standing in the middle of the road. And he was clearly going to run over this kid and kill him. And he was wondering, why is this kid standing in the middle of the road? What is happening? And then the kid looks up. And his wings come out and he flies away. And it was like a, 3.5 foot tall barn owl, like a giant barn owl.
Oh, wow.
Sitting in the middle of the road. So it's like, I know it's very easy to, mischaracterize things you see, especially, late at night. But this video is fairly unambiguous. This is, I'm going to say, it could be a kid wearing a brown parka and matching brown pants running through in the middle of the night.
I think that's probably the biggest, that would be the Occam's razor of it all, right? It's just somebody in loose fitting winter clothes running across the road.
Yeah. And of
or
course,
an animal that just looks, it makes it look like it's bipedal.
But usually this is also when, of course, people are like, well, why would a kid be running across the road? This is 2:30 in the morning. It's like, I don't know, maybe he got his first, you know, sexy action with a girl and now he's, you know, coming home. I'm making up all this stuff about what this kid's up to in Russia. I mean, well, but my point is, my point is, no matter how far-fetched a story I can make up, it's less far-fetched than the idea that, you know, that a tribe of ape men has escaped our view until this lucky dash cam.
I have a friend that, like, he'll send me, like, UFO stuff, and it's like, this looks like an aviation flare. It's like, well, what are they doing over this time? I'm like, you demand an explanation why the Air Force is doing an exercise at 3 a.m. in some middle of nowhere, but you're obvious as, therefore, it must be aliens. You're more likely to believe, you know, I'm like,
well, that's the other thing is, remember when the late 90s when they released a classified status on a whole bunch of docs of just some of the weird ass stuff that the military did just to do it? Like, they're like, we want to know if it's possible for a body to have a misfire on its ejection seat so the parachute doesn't come out. And so we put this dummy on a ejection sheet and we ejected him and threw him out and just let him crash in the middle of the desert. We did it like 30 times. We didn't find one of them. And then it's like that's a weird ass thing, but it's less weird than the idea that the known laws of physics don't work.
Yeah.
Yep.
Man, I'll tell you what, between like that, those stories and all the assassination attempts on Castro, there was just a lot of rubber stamping back in the day.
Oh, my God.
A lot of like, whatever, fine, let's do it. Sounds good. Right. We'll send crabs to him. Train crabs with a flute and that'll get him.
Wasn't it a real thing that they were going to put a bomb in a Cuban cigar? And well, as if it's like the deadliest Johnson Smith Company catalog novelty, you know, he'd be three puffs in.
That, like, all those, you have a meeting of a bunch of people, some generals, some other people, about what to do. And somebody says, I have an idea. And it's like the dumbest idea ever, but it's on the record. And then it's like, government said that, and not that they didn't do their own, didn't approve stupid stuff, but it was like, oh, the government wanted to do this. Like, no, one guy in a meeting said, why don't we do this? And it never went beyond that. But now it's like, somebody said that.
Man, the Cold War. Those were the good old days when America's slogan was, sure, why not? Let's go for it.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
So we got what's amazing about our readership, our listenership is it's very important to remember that, like, I would say even individually, they're going to be smarter than us, collectively, absolutely too. And so on our discussion about the whole idea, is the brain some sort of quantum mechanical sort of device or whatever like that? I made a lot of generalizations and I will own up to that. And we have somebody who's wants to provide some clarification. And let me read this. This was sent to Neshcom, so I'll read it as if I were Neshcom reading his mail. Or that's Bryce for you. It says, I have a message for that idiot Andrew and Brian. I added that part.
Little bit of editorialization happening.
Yeah!
I just wanted to clarify some points that were slightly confused, misinterpreted in the episode. You're being kind. I don't mean to nitpick and say, point, you're wrong. But
we were.
Just further vet some other points made in the episode and central to the conversation. All right, yeah. Who are you, sir, to question us? Me, a cruise ship magician. Justin, well, we don't know what he does. And Brian, a fire eater.
I was not named.
Yeah, that's right. No, he didn't need to be corrected.
I have a PhD in organic chemistry from MIT, so I'm not just talking out of my butt. strictly speaking, different isotopes are not 100% chemically the same. And let me just say right now, he's absolutely correct. And if I was trying to frame it differently, I would say that was correct. I was trying to mean, when I said the chemically the same, I meant from in classical physics, not getting into quantum stuff, you would go, these are the same. And they're not. They're absolutely not. But I did not make that clear. Thus, the fact hammer slamming down on me.
Hey, real quick, time out.
Take the L. Take the L, Andrew. This is the L. You too, Brian. You share an L. Break it like the wishbone.
That's fine. That's fine. This is the part where I try really hard to figure out what we're being corrected on. Which discussion was this? What were we talking about before?
So we were talking about the idea that, like, is the brain, I was bringing up the theory this physicist had that the brain could be actually functioning some quantum level because he was looking at drugs that had lithium that sometimes used an isotope of lithium and behaved differently, right?
Got it.
And he was extrapolating that into the idea that perhaps there are some quantum processes that take place in how we think and how we handle stuff. I was trying to make the, you know, I was trying to say, like, it's an interesting point because we're discovering these quantum effects, you know, that happen when you know inside of different forms of chemical processes. And I made some very generalizations about saying, like, yeah, in chemistry, you know, isotopes don't make a difference, whatever, which is not true. What I was trying to say was that, like, if you just approach it from, like, a periodic table point of view,
sure,
that doesn't make an effect, but they absolutely make an effect. And let me read the rest of it because he articulates it far better than I do. Or, you know, artfully and correctly, he says, strictly speaking, different isotopes are not 100% chemically the same. The vast majority of properties are similar. However, when it comes to making and breaking bonds, different isotopes can result in reaction rates. This has to do to small differences in zero-point energies. The most famous example is hydrogen versus deuterium. A carbon-deuterium bond has a lower zero-point energy than a carbon-hydrogen bond. So, deuterium...
So real quick, so I can picture. I know carbon has four connections, right? You picture the plus symbol. Hydrogen has one connection. Normally, that's what methane is. You got a carbon and four hydrogens on there. But a carbon deuterium bond is substantively different, is what you're saying? Deuterium being an isotope of hydrogen.
I think that the difference just happens to the let me just continue on.
All right. Let's let the expert. Yes.
Yeah, a carbon has a lower zero-point energy than a carbon hydrogen, so it's a lower energy level. This means that the activation energy for a specific reaction will be slightly higher for deuterium than hydrogen. So in theory, like, the bond wouldn't look different. If you looked at the model, it would look different. But remember that because of the different – there's a different density in that deuterium. It's a heavier atom. You know, it's heavier, and so it's not like there's no effect to that at all. So – as he points out, you can look up the kinetic isotope effect, which I'm going to point out, by the way, vaguely familiar with it, but the kinetic isotope effect deals with how these different bonds affect whatever. One of the explanations for that, or the prevailing, is quantum tunneling. It gets back into the best explanation is looking at it from a quantum physics point of view and how energy moves from one point to the other, which we don't have a model for how these things work in conventional chemistry. When I say conventional chemistry, I mean non-isotopic chemistry, whatever. And so isotopic chemistry started around Manhattan Project stuff. And then the deuterium stuff was like in the 70s and stuff where they first started saying, hey, maybe there's a difference here.
Real quick, if I could just for the listeners, you ever start playing a video game and you think it's going to be super easy and all of a sudden you realize the skill level just whoop? That's kind of what we just did on the podcast. All right, let's keep going.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, this is a guy listening to us going, no, guys, let me clarify this for you. So yeah. He points out the quantum effect has such vibrational modes are directly related to Schrodinger's equation, meaning what's going to happen here, et cetera. In the end, all chemistry is quantum mechanics, is very complicated, practically unsolvable equations. Is what does all this mean? Biochemistry is all about reaction kinetics and competitive binding. Therefore, putting in a different isotope can possibly slightly alter a complex cascade of reactions and interactions, giving different results. Drug companies are even looking into the deuterated drugs now to exploit these differences. That means ones that are using deuterium instead of just regular hydrogen. Okay. So the idea is they're saying, man, if we use this isotopic hydrogen, maybe it affects things differently. That's me adding that in. So this is why I would not recommend downing a bottle of heavy water deuterium oxide. Noted. So in conclusion, yes, the brain is quantum because chemistry is quantum and isotopes do have different chemical properties. If Andrew or Brian would like to chat over email or Twitter, be happy to answer any questions. Sir, you've done a great job. And again, we love this. We absolutely love this when, you know, we try to cover a lot of topics. And I'd say the three of us, we like to be knowledgeable about stuff, but we don't have a lot of deep knowledge in a lot of areas. And so it's great when people who actually know this stuff can go in and go,
Well, actually.
I mean, listen. All right. Yeah. So this is a great example, or a great way, a self-depreciating example that we can make a comment about media in general. People that you follow on podcasts or television, many times even columnists, writers, they are good at being entertaining. And hopefully they cannot get things too wrong and they can continue their knowledge with you. But our job here primarily is to be a fun show that pretends to be knowledgeable, which is why we, I think, unlike many other people that can get stuck in the trap of believing that they indeed are the font of knowledge, welcome anybody who actually knows more than us so we can then bring your information to the stage and synthesize it in the most entertaining way possible.
Heck yes.
Yeah, and we appreciate that. And as somebody points out, you know, you can always ask other people, and you can, but I'm involved in a group in LA that, like, when, like, researchers and stuff or people who are writing books or scripts and stuff like that have science questions and stuff, you know, I sometimes get stuff because I'm like, well, go talk to so-and-so. And they're like, what about these two physicists? I'm like, that's not their expertise. They'll give you an answer, but it won't be as deep as this other person, because everybody, myself included, loves to have opinions, loves to be able to tell you stuff. But some people are much better answering it than others. So I would suggest, when it comes to questions about, you know, brain chemistry and stuff, you know, an organic chemist from MIT probably is going to know more, you know.
And listen, let's just say there's a reason why we started the podcast with the Yeti sighting.
Exactly. But again, we appreciate that. We know there are a lot of people out there that listen. And then sometimes, you know, you'll hear us, you know, and sometimes we're just trying to generalize to the point of making something not true, which is good. Please don't be afraid to go on. You're not going to hurt our feelings or whatever. I mean, we love to know when we're baffled to find out that smart people are listening.
Humbled and honored.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I've had great discussions with people who are like, well, let me clarify this for you. I'm like, oh okay. It's good. Now I know. Don't drink a bunch of deuterium oxide.
Dude, no, that's important, because G.I. Joe just barely beat Cobra to the heavy water because they had to fight the giant tube worms in order to get the three different substances.
I would come home and eat my Little Debbie's cakes and watch that. That was when G.I. Joe was this special mini-series run after school TV, sitting there watching the latest episodes as they're getting that heavy water.
That one in the Trials of Lino, G.I. Joe had the, like, we need the three Jeep drops to get in the gloop glop, otherwise the world ends. But then they came back 2 years later. They're like, now there's six gloop globs that have to go on the bleep blob. And then Zartan shows up and he's like, nah, we're on our side. We have a stake in the game.
Hey, by the way, speaking of G.I. Joe, former guest on this show, Aubrey Sitterson, is currently writing the new relaunched comic line of G.I. Joe. He did a big Street Fighter versus G.I. Joe tournament mini, and now he's writing the new line. So everybody go ahead and support Aubrey, who is a rad dude, and everything I've read that he's done so far is great. And he has, a like all of us, an abiding love for those G.I. Joe characters.
Speaking of support.
Hey, everybody, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support us. Hey, you know, while you're rushing out to buy Aubrey Sitterson's comic, why don't you throw a few shekels our way, huh?
Hey,
I mean,
you're
showing up every single week doing this show for you.
So do you realize, like, you know, there's been a lot of fluctuations. There's been changes in the way that that Patreon runs stuff. But I'm right now looking at Graphtreon, Graphtreon.com/creator/weirdthings. Over the life of our run, there was this big moment when everything reset and they recalculated the way they tally everything up. We've never been above $500 an episode, and we are unbelievably close. We are $491.70 per episode. If you guys enjoy the show, you get your very own RSS feed. You get to listen to the show and after things immediately after, all in a big old 2.5 hour rock block. Can't recommend it enough. Let's get over 500 an episode. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, let's just do it for the fun of it, you know, and the money in our pockets. But that's not the reason.
By the way, I love the coy emails because we let the funds build up for a while and then we cash it out like two or three times a year. And Andrew sends me a text saying, "Hey, man, I feel really bad asking, but it seems like I might have an opportunity to come into money. There's a certain Nigerian prince, but I've got to send him some cash right away. Is there a chance that we could cash out that Patreon?"
Sounded like a great business opportunity, and I promised to share with you the vast fortune when they I've sent off my cashier's check, guys. Don't worry, any day now, I won't forget you.
You're just paying the taxes on that money.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, otherwise, how you can't just send money overwards. Right. You got to pay money to get money.
Do I have to explain how our commerce works to everybody?
Agreed.
So, speaking of commerce, gentlemen, we've talked about this. We've talked around it a little bit. About what happens when robots take our jobs. And there was a very, very good item, column, by Mr. Matt Ridley, actually Viscount Matt Ridley, who is in the House of Lords, one of our heroes here. And he has a piece in the Times, which would be the UK Times, not New York Times, and it's about artificial intelligence is not going to cause mass unemployment.
How do you figure? Because before you give me the actual answer, I'm assuming the questions he's about to answer, because I've been wrestling with this a lot, we have 3 million people whose job it is to drive, and we've got double that whose job it is to serve. There's a reason we call it the service economy, and it just seems like all of that's going to go away, right? With robots?
So the answer is quite simple, is that the robots will send us all to death camps before we lose our jobs.
Oh, got it.
Problem solved. Not a job lost. No, that's not what he said. He makes a very cogent article.
By the way, I do love the idea that robot death camps will not be factored into our unemployment numbers. So it'll be if you are no longer looking for a job, you don't count. And if you've been sent to a robot death camp, you will not be counted in our unemployment numbers.
Well, I mean, why? That would be dumb, Justin, because you're dead when you're hired. They didn't fire you before you died. Actually, in all seriousness, he talks about, I'll start off with, he compares people with this sort of mentality as the Luddites, and Matt's wonderful way of pointing out historical context. He says that we've always had this fear that mechanization and automation are going to put us out of work. And he, you know, gets into the point of showing, you know, how, you know, but you look at how 90% of the people, you know, over 100 years ago, 90% of the population was involved in farming. You know, like farming. We're all farmers. You know, 90% of everybody, like you go back 150 years, your family was farmers. We all were farmers. And it's a hard thing to sort of kind of, you know, it's, we understand that, but we don't really understand the idea that, no, everybody you knew was a farmer. Everybody was a farmer.
Well, and Matt really does a really good job in The Rational Economist and in the talks that you can find of him online. He says, you know, people praise self-sufficiency, but we have a word for that. It's called subsistence farming, a.k.a. poverty. Like, that's what it means when you grow just enough food to keep living. And instead, it's only through free trade and all of us working together and specializing that we're able to grow the pie for everyone.
Yeah, so he gets into the idea of saying that, listen, is that we've always transitioned away from that into better paying jobs, into better things. And so when we gave up farming, we became wealthier for doing that, because when we let those machines do that, we went into this, you know, these other sort of areas that required a higher skill set or other things. And we moved pretty much en masse with that. And we have, you know, we are all far wealthier than we were when we were all farmers. And if you went back to, you know, when our founding fathers were forming our country and doing a brilliant job of it, though, we were all kind of agrarian. You're like, hey, guess what? In 200 years from now, you're not going to know a single farmer. You'd be like, you know, we're all going to be unemployed. What are we going to do? You know, it's like, we're going to be doing a lot of other stuff, things that we can't even describe now because we don't have the context, but service economy, part of it, information, all that. So he gets into it. It's really worth reading his art, reading the thing. He points out there.
Where can we look for this, by the way?
If you go to rationaloptimist.com.
Got it.
Go to rationaloptimist.com. Click on blog. He reprints the article there. He is he takes apart some people that like, you know, Tyler Cowen, who I think is a really fascinating economics writer, George Mason, but he points out, like Tyler Cowen said, you know, think of the digital social Darwinism, the clear winners and losers. Those with the talent and skills to work seamlessly with technology and compete in the global marketplace are increasingly rewarded, while those whose jobs can easily be done by foreigners, robots, or a few thousand lines of codes suffer accordingly. Matt writes, responds to that in his column saying, yet we have been automating the workforce for two centuries, and so far the effect is to create more jobs, not fewer. Farming once employed more than 90% of the people, and without them we would have starved. Today it's just a few percent. The followers of the mysterious Captain Swing, who destroyed threshing machines in 1830, were convinced that machines still work, instead of which farm laborers became factory workers later became call center workers. In both transitions, pay rose and work became safer, less physically demanding, and less exposed to the elements. And so he goes through pointing out a number of these points in the past where we've said, hey, this is going to happen, and kind of say, hey, yeah, we've been crying this, but we've gone through these big transitions before. And then he addresses the idea of like, well, are we going to hollow out the economy, which is a fear, that the idea that the polarization where we just lose a middle class and we just have a lot of poor people and some really, really wealthy people. And he cites some stuff by Don Boudreau, whose stuff I think is really very well articulated and all that. So he's making a very, I think it's worth reading, of his point about how, no, we've continuously moved. And I think that he's applying the same logic to, like, because, you know, I talk to people like, well, like, what if we run out of food? Like, no, we keep producing more. You know, what if we run out of jobs? No, we'll keep inventing more.
So, I mean,
it appears as if he's saying that the one thing that we are better at than losing jobs by way of automation is that automation inevitably helps us create more cruddy jobs. We will never be without cruddy jobs, like, you know, farmer.
I mean, I don't even know about cruddy jobs, because, like, you know, let's say and I get where you're coming from, but I want, like, our destiny is to all become artists, right, of some variety.
I don't know that.
Well, I mean,
yeah, I think it's easy for us, all people who create things. I mean, obviously, we always look through the world in our own image. Everybody on this podcast has something available right now for sale that is an artistic creation. But I do think that the way that we conceptualize what work is has and will continue to shift. And I think what the point of this is to say that we have always been worried that it will go away, and yet it has not. So why are these specific challenges different than all the versions of mechanization that we've seen in the past?
I would, Brian, to your point, I would certainly say that we there is a trend towards doing. I mean, there's the hard problems we still have to solve, but there'll always be hard problems to solve in human society. And, well, let's try to solve this problem or whatever, and probably getting the AI going, what about this? But I would say yes. I would say that entertaining each other, you know, and doing the things that we did when we walked off the farm and sat around on the porch to, you know, fill up the rest
of the time.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess ultimately, and this is the beautiful part. Everything I'm saying is absolutely 100% wrong, because of course the most popular job is one that the three of us, if our life's work was to do nothing but guess what the most popular job 200 years from now would be, we cannot even conceive of the need for the job that'll be the most popular.
What's the most popular now?
Well, it was 200 years ago farming, or I guess.
Your most common job.
Right. Correct. Not what everyone wants to be, but it was farming, and then it was industrial work, and now it's service work, and it's moving into, you know, this post-service economy.
I would just say, it's interesting, we have twice as many government workers as we do manufacturing people in our country.
All right. So there's so many different places to go. It's so fascinating. Yeah. So I have this weird gut feeling that once we get robots doing all the survival stuff, including things like automating vaccine trials and coming up with, you know, computers that write other programs to do more computing for us and so on, it seems like like the three jobs I can think of is that humans will do is, you know, scientists, men of, and women of leisure who basically try to solve big problems and understand things. Entertainers, you know, artists of all varieties who seek to, provide value in other people's lives.
Being a chef, we would put into that category.
Correct. Yes. And I guess explorers, people who are like, let's get off this rock and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Is there any other big category that you could think of that we'll be doing once robots do everything we don't want to?
I think that you're going to still need people creating companies to address human needs. You're going to still need inventors. You're going to still need people who are sort of the liaison between computer technology and human needs and wants, you know, and we can, you know, we can generalize so many things into those categories and kind of at the danger of sort of losing sight of how different many of those things can be, because, you know, a writing a newspaper, you know, is the same as being somebody who's a chef, you know, although we'd say those are very, very different jobs. So we look at it and we go like, nah, you're kind of really an entertainment. Let's be honest.
Right. Ultimately, like you're not providing the food to give sustenance. You're providing food for entertainment, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that there's going to be, you know, a lot of big things. I'm not a big person in the universal basic income or the minimum income.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought it up first, because that's all I could think of. I can't imagine that it's not going to happen. Once the robots, I mean, regardless of what your political affiliation is, if I was going to place a bet, once the robots have won the game so hard that we don't ever have to worry about food or let's say healthcare and all that stuff, like, at some point, the pie will be so big that people will want everyone to have money automatically given to them so that they could spend it on stuff that they do.
Yeah, but my point is that, like, if you want to live a very, very simple life right now, if you want to live a very, very, very simple life, you know, you could work from 20 to 30, put away enough money, and you could do that. But that simple life is going to mean, you know, you don't have cable, you don't have this, you're living in, you know, a rural sort of place on a small plot of land, buying basic groceries and things like that. But you would be living like people did 100 years ago, and you'd have that. You go to, I mean, there are ways to, I mean, you know, we have friends who are like extremely frugal who can probably, who have done that kind of thing.
I believe the stat that I read at some point was that to live a middle class lifestyle in the 1970s, you could do that today on a quote unquote poverty level income.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's not hard to do. But the problem is you think about what I get into is like, think about the idea of like, well, what if I want to live in San Francisco? Sorry, you can't. If you have a minimum basic income, you can't do that because it's way too expensive. What if I want to live in a major city? No, you won't be able to do that at minimum basic income because guess what? Real estate's too expensive. When you start thinking about like so much of what how our income works is based upon where we choose to live and things like that. And that's one of the quickest, you'll see a sharp polarization all of a sudden. If you have, I don't have to, cause not everybody will be able to afford it because it can't fit enough people. There's like real estate is like a good example of where that gets to be problematic. And it's like, oh, I'm going to go on a vacation. I'm going to stay at a hotel. Well, do I want to go to the minimum basic income hotel or do I want to go to the nice hotel? And that's where that's the danger is that we think that like we kind of like, oh, all of this life of leisure. Yeah, but the ones that work and make more are going to have a lot more.
That's interesting. I think we've talked about this on the show before, but it reminds me of, you know, that crazy experiment of Second Life, you know, this virtual world where real estate was unlimited and all the basics ability were free. You could travel anywhere. You could watch just about anything. And so essentially everyone became artists. They would design clothes that you could buy to put on your avatar. They would design swords and, you know, a badder ass katana than the other guy. I feel like that's where we're headed. We're never going to stop wanting something slightly better than what we have, right?
But I like a big thing is where we live. I mean, I think that's a big thing is just the idea of like, you know, that is like the clearest example you can see that it's going to have and have not is where you get to live. And I look at like, you know, having an apartment in California and a house. I look at how much, you know, how much most of my, you know, most of like my monthly nut is paying for the luxury of being able to live in those places, you know? So, you know, I just kind of think that like it's this, and I think you extrapolate that to the future where, you know, if I didn't work as much as I did, my choices would be much more limited. And I think that that's the thing is where you look at the upset like happening in San Francisco with like people throwing rocks at Google buses and things like that, because these people with much higher incomes of coming in are displacing them. And I could see that if we're all kind of become a welfare state, that's my fear is that.
Which by the way, happening in the next 2 years in Austin, I guarantee you.
What's going to happen?
That exact same situation. Like so many of the parallels between, especially being downtown in Austin over the last like 2 weeks. It's like, man, that looks like what I would have projected Oakland looked like 3 years before I got there.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
And you know, the difference is in Austin, you can sprawl out a little bit more, but at the same time, because the highway infrastructure is so limited, you're going to have the exact same bus situation where people are going to be living in other places and then busing there and people are going to be upset about it. Like it's going to be the same.
Like the Google bus thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I'm so curious to see how it all shakes out. I'm going to make a note here. Remember to live forever so I can know how everything works out. Got it.
Brian will be enjoying it with his telescope from Dripping Springs.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Oh, man. Hey, they sure seem upset. I swear, hey, Bonnie, come here. Look, this guy's really upset. Oh, look at him.
I understand the appeal. Like when people talk about minimum basic income, I understand the appeal of that. But it's one of those things you have to stop and sort of think through, like, what is the outcome of that? Because you look at, you know, part of if you understand where wealth polarization comes into, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're not saving money, somebody who just saves 6%, 7% from every paycheck is going to not just have just be outpacing you. They're going to have an accelerated rate of outpacing your income level. Yeah. You know, when you look at that over 20, 30 years, and they're going to jump up an entire income brackets, while it may not look different in a micro, you know, frame, when you expand that and when you talk about minimum basic income, where you talk about like, you know, that's been the challenge of, you know, the welfare system is the idea that, you know, in a society that tries to look out for everybody is you want to make it so when people encounter hardships and stuff that they're not starving, you know, they're not, you know, destitute or whatever. But it's like, okay, what's the balance between that and not creating a generational problem where the next generation is dependent
all of a sudden, like it becomes classism where it's like you were just born in the wrong class. By the way, one book that explores this idea peripherally, but really, really cool is The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson. Mm-hmm. In it, there's two siblings and one of them is adopted by the Victorians. There's different. The idea is because, you know, through nanobots or whatever, you're able to create so many different things. You have these different bubbles. Like there's some people who say, you know what, the best that humanity ever was in the Victorian age. So we're going to adopt that dress style, that manner of speech, and we're just going to choose to live in the Victorian age. You know, we'll have parlor rooms and we'll be concerned with high society things. And then meanwhile, there's another sibling that grows up on the streets, obsessed with, you know, just gang war, turf territory and all that stuff. And of course, you know, he has food to eat and he doesn't have to learn how to read. He's, you know, the basic symbols do him just fine. But it very much is this kind of have and have not society. Although even the have nots have as much as they want, as far as they want to contribute in anything. It's really interesting.
Yeah, he thinks about things very, very deeply in a very interesting way. And my solution to avoid those situations is, and that's kind of like, as you mentioned in the part of the premise there is this, the primer, the idea that, you know, the idea of this access to education, if you can make it available to anybody who, you know, make it easily accessible to anybody who wants to sort of educate themselves and become better at, you know, providing some sort of utility, that's the ideal for me. That, you know, whatever system, you just make it so anybody, you can be born in any situation, have access to education. And I don't mean like a $60,000 a year stupid school. I mean actually learning useful skills.
Sure. So. And separately, and one of the more interesting arguments I've heard for the universal basic income is that is that it would unlock human ingenuity for more interesting things. And the point they bring up, and this is part of the reason, like, you know, YCombinator.com is actually financing a small scale test of UBI to see how it goes. But the argument, one of the arguments they make is that the biggest scientific advancements in the 19th century were conducted by people who didn't work for a living. They were men of leisure who had money, and they were able to, for the status they could get, invest their time and effort in, you know, doing things like, you know, categorizing finches and all of that stuff, which, again, I am not speaking to whether or not they're right or wrong, but I thought it was a really interesting take on it.
Yeah, I would. And my response to that, I've read that, is that one is that it may have been those guys had the time to find the low hanging fruit. Two, and there could have been a hell of a lot more of it if you had a professional class of that, because you look at how long it took to get things done, and they were the only ones doing that. So it's hard, because it's like I've had this discussion with Matt Ridley, though, because we're talking about, like, you know, like, you know, we have sort of maybe different views and sort of like copyrights and stuff. He's like, well, you know, Mozart did fine. I'm like, yeah, you had one Mozart, only one guy. He got sponsored by the state to make music. The thing that's interesting to me is that I have both personally witnessed people who are very high output, intelligent people who all of a sudden didn't have to worry about income. And I watched their output drop. You know, somebody who wrote a book every 4 years to zero books over a 20-year period. You had one of the founders of BlackBerry, you know, of RIM, you know, created this institute in, you know, Canada to, like, do advanced physics research. And we've had these other, like, physics research, you know, institutions in the United States where, like, we're going to get the best and the most brilliant people in the world, and we're going to put them together and not let them worry about grants or anything, free of any of this sort of restraints. And their output's like nothing. I mean, they just, it's just without having to solve and deal with a ready crisis or solve an immediate problem, their output goes to, you know, drops precipitously. And that's, it's anecdotal, but that's my thing. It's like, I've seen, once people get comfortable and they don't have to work for it, they don't do anything.
Interesting.
So, I think there's, man, like, I know as a writer, nothing's more motivating than, you know,
deadlines,
food. Yeah. You know, I'm much more productive when I'm like, how am I not going to be homeless next year? Speaking of homeless, we've got two wayward homeless people on the road.
Oh, my Lord!
All right. If I remember correctly, we mainly followed Justin's side of the journey as he navigated his way through the underground complex surrounded by Quiznos, Dr. Pepper, SpaceX, DuPont, Stamps.com, and Casper Mattresses.
And I think Justin killed Mark Maron. Is that how we...
Yeah, did that happen?
I sold out Mark Maron... either in the same breath or right after I quoted Gucci Mane, and he was tortured and killed. They are on the hunt to understand the cult of Diamond Club, because they believe that the cult of Diamond Club is somehow tied to this scourge, and they are very keen on killing anybody who might be a part of it.
Let me speak as the spokesperson on behalf of the Protectorate.
Wait, how did you into our inner dialogue, sir?
No, I'm in front of him right now, sitting at the table.
Okay.
All right?
How did I get to you then? I'm in another part of the complex.
Oh, well, we'll talk about that in a second, Brian. But to clarify, we're trying to stop the spread of this disease, and we do not have a lot of time to waste. And I asked you honestly, like, hey, we need to talk to somebody else who might be a Diamond Club. Just give us a name. And you're like, Mark Maron. We're like, we trust Justin. Justin would not lie to us. I mean,
and
Justin.
And then what did you do? You went and killed him.
That we went to ask Mark Maron.
And guess what? You failed.
No, you don't get to play it left. We asked Mark Maron, we're like, hey, listen, we're really trying. We're under time crunch. We need to solve this thing. Justin says you're a member of Diamond Club. He's like, I don't know anything about it. We're like, all right, listen, you're lying to us, because Justin would not lie to us. Either you're a liar or Justin's a liar. Who's the liar? It's like, Justin must be a liar. And we're like, don't call him a liar, and slapped him, you know? And then he's like, no, Justin's lying. Like, good time is ticking, Mark Maron. You know, like, put a gun on the table. Like, we put one bullet in the chamber. We're going to spin it around. You got six chances. You got five chances to tell us the truth here, right? Like, tell us about Diamond Club. I don't know anything about Diamond Club. We're like, all right, this is bullet number one. Bam. Okay. It was in the first chamber. My mistake.
Yeah.
I was meant to scare him.
Also, it was an automatic. That was probably a problem.
You know how hard it is to get blanks in an apocalypse?
You want to know what? You want to know about Diamond Club? I'll tell you anything you need to know about Diamond Club, but I need Brian by my side. We need to get Brian in here right now because he knows half this story, including the half that I don't know because we were separated at the time that everything went down.
Meanwhile, wherever I am, I'm trying to reenact that scene from War Games where it's like I'm taking an old tape recorder and using some forceps to clamp them on, and I'm hoping it'll go doot, 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 so that I can play it back.
As you're doing this, the doctor and his helper are watching you as you're restrained in some sort of delirium, moving your hands and your fingers. He's like, what is he doing? It's like, I don't know. Did he just make a deep, deep, does that have like the sound from War Games? Like when he like, I think that is. And like, wait, that's actually our door code. Close it and change it.
Okay. How fortunate.
So, Brian, your eyes get pried open, right? And the doctor, probably not an actual doctor, but he's staring into you. He's like, Brian, today is your lucky day.
Is it because you have more Quiznos? I never quite
Brian, got... if you cooperate and you relax, you're going to have all the Quiznos you want.
All right, I'm in.
Brian, as you know, people upstairs say things are getting kind of scary out there. It's a terrifying world.
Take it from me. Independent podcaster in the apocalypse. It's rough.
We need some help. We got to bring law and order to this world. And I don't know if we're going to be able to reverse it. I don't think society is coming back the way it came back. You know, I don't think it's coming back. Not that it ever came back, but you know what I mean? I'm not good at speeches, Brian.
All right. Well, what can I do? First of all, can you untie me? I think I'd be more helpful if I weren't tied down.
Oh, Brian, you're going to be happy for the restraints in a moment once you understand what's happening.
Oh, that sounds ominous.
Do you feel the world needs a hero, Brian?
Okay.
You're with me, right? Right? We can use a hero, right?
Sure. Yeah, I know heroes are great.
Brian, you see these X-rays all around you? These X-rays, these like bones with special implants and things like that. Heroes, Brian. Heroes, all of them.
Oh dear, you mean like people willing to sacrifice their lives for the greater good? I don't think we need more of those.
They sacrificed their life for you.
Oh, well, maybe this is okay. Tell me more,
Brian. What I want to do is I'm trying to create superhuman technology here.
Oh boy. It's with
I can replace your ligaments with these nylon materials that are faster, stronger. I can imbue your bones with, quote, a material that actually existed prior to Timely Comics and Marvel, adamantium.
Okay. All right. Right on. Yes.
Not more of adamantium.
Hey, whatever you're telling me, I'm betting, just assume I'm saying yes to all of the upgrades. Every upgrade you could possibly give me, I want the whole works. Total package.
You're down with it?
Yeah. No, let's go.
Fantastic. Javier, get out the skull saw.
It's fine. I didn't hear that. I'm thinking about Quiznos. Okay. And they're delightful.
Yeah, we're gonna do a little tiny implant in your head too.
Toasted sandwiches.
The hell are you?
Makes it so much better.
God, these damn pipes and voices going through here.
But I want Brian by my side right now. That's what I want. I want Brian Rushwood by my side right now.
Hey, guys, don't mind that. I'm just working on my ventriloquism skills. That sounded like a good impression of Justin.
Here, I got some Quiznos wrappers to shove into the pipe.
Okay, good. Just real fast. Upgrade everything. Let's go.
I don't care what he's doing or where he is. Yank him out wherever he is right now and put him right next to me.
Brian, there's just one more thing. I got to explain this to you before you sign the consent form. Even in an apocalypse, I've got paperwork.
Got it. Okay. Roger.
Do you ever wake up in the morning and you're like, hey, let me check my email and let me go through all this. And you're like checking it and you're like, man, I'm still in bed. I haven't picked up my phone or my iPad. I'm just sort of imagining I'm doing this.
You've done this, right?
Sure.
I did it this morning.
How would you like to imagine no more, Brian?
Wait, what do you mean? I could actually just lay in bed?
No, Brian, but what I'm saying is we could put an internet access in your head.
Oh, man. Wait, is there still an internet? I thought the internet was gone.
We got our secret internet, Brian. It's a satellite internet.
Secret internet. Yes. No. Sign me up with the secret internet and the adamantium bones and the ligament replacement. Right. Look, we already had this discussion. The answer is yes to all of them.
Okay. And we've got our own version of Siri we're going to put in your head.
Good.
And ask questions for.
Good. Let's rock it.
Yeah.
I want that Y-Bri. Let's go.
Yeah, it's not called Siri. It's a totally different name. You'll get to know.
Okay.
Explain it.
It's Breary?
Adolf. It's called Adolf. Don't worry.
Hey.
What the hell? Adolf?
We were looking for names that aren't that common anymore. Everybody knows the name, but it's not a popular name, so it'll be called Adolf, okay? So Adolf is going to be your personal assistant.
Okay, right on. I mean, if you say so.
I had my German researchers help me do it. Really great engineering, precise. There's a little
that
bit of an accent.
Really
not going to worry about that.
Ethnically specific for you to bring up, but I assume they're qualified. You said they're reason. You said
totally qualified. Totally qualified.
Great.
Sometimes it's a little bit angry, but it's totally cool. All right, good. We're going to just breathe this in.
Sure.
It's a Xylon B on the tank. It's a joke. Breathe this in.
Wow, you guys have a dark
Mine
sense of humor.
Passes out. All right. Staple gun, sewing, hot glue.
I zapped my peppers from my Quinn's nose. Let me get them out of his chest cavity. All right. Now, as a little treat, I am going to put the roast beef sandwich in his tummy.
Sew it up. So you're smiling as you're having your surgery.
I wake up with the itis. I want to go back to sleep.
All right. Now, Justin, meanwhile, is still fuming. His hands are on his hips. He's like, I want to talk to Brian. he's starting to do a Gollum thing, Justin, Brian, in there by himself. All right. Couple hours later, Brian, you wake up. You open up your eyes. We're holding a birthday cake for you. We got a birthday cake. It's your first day. Is Brian 2.0.
Right on. Adolf, play.
Yeah,
mixtape cake eating
Flight
music.
Of the Valkyries? Sure. Actually, Ride of the Valkyries. Okay, but we'll call right. it
Adolf,
Flight.
Adolf, stop playback. Stop playback. All right, look. Hey, I'm sure. Look, part of me just wants to try out all my new powers immediately, but I feel like somewhere in this building, Justin probably needs me for something. Is he around?
Hold on. One question. Yes, we'll get hold of you in a second. You sure you don't want to have some craft work?
Adolf, order toilet paper and take me to Justin.
Yeah. All right. All of a sudden, like, hey, we have the cake. Brian, just eat the cake with us. It's strudel. You'll like it. Okay. You have some cake. You're like, man, you really like the strudel, by the way. It's really, really good. It's really, really good.
It's weird because before the surgery, I never liked strudel before, but now I just can't.
Don't worry. You got an expanded sense of taste and all that.
Oh,
okay.
I think my palate's dead. Did you guys put some things on my taste buds? Is that what's going to do? I have an expanded palate.
Gave you some enhancements and some biological enhancements too.
Awesome.
Maybe some genetics. Maybe a little rewrite of your genetic code too.
All right. Look, I got to go rub this in Justin's face. Let's go. Let's go find Justin. I start
right,
bouncing.
You got a map appears in front of you, and it's telling you which way to go. We're like, you're free, Brian. You can go as free as you want.
I give a thumbs up, which I assume I still have just two thumbs. So I give just two thumbs ups, unless
yeah,
they
but
give me
your
more thumbs.
Your right hand kind of goes flat and straight out.
Right. Okay. No biggie. I follow the map that Adolf is projecting in my mind, and hopefully find Justin.
Yep, and you goose step, I mean walk down the hall.
Knock on the door, and I'm like,
open the door, you say. You're like, well, that was not polite.
I'm like, I'm Justin. What's up? What do you need? What's going on?
Papers.
Rolling papers, please. Am I right? No. Okay. All right. Hey man, what's going on?
Did you become a Nazi cyborg?
I mean,
it's like, you know, we didn't like explicitly state it in our mission. It was find Andrew, find Ashley, set up new lives in the apocalypse.
Yeah.
I know it wasn't explicitly stated in there. Don't become a Nazi cyborg.
I mean,
but like, I would have assumed it was implied that you shouldn't voluntarily undergo surgery so you can become a Nazi cyborg. Because I heard you stuffing Quiznos wrappers in the vents so you wouldn't hear me. But I could still hear everything that was going on in your side of the compound. These people want to know everything about us. And now they have undoubtedly, along with your Nazi cyborg add-ons, added every kind of surveillance that they could forever want. Anything that we could ever keep secret has totally gone out the window. And Brian, no. Why? Why would you do this?
I mean, in the great words of the poet-philosopher Walter Sobchak, say what you will of the tenets of National Socialism, at least it's an ethos. Right? Come on. It's like, look, they made possible. We're going to be able to bust out of here. I'm like a Superman. I don't know what my powers are yet.
Using the powers that they gave you.
Okay, hold on real quick.
Something that they haven't thought about was that you running wild on their operation.
All right, hold on. Look how high I can jump. Actually, you jump first. How high can you jump?
I jump a meager amount.
Okay, and then I jump. How high do I go, Andrew?
I would say that, like, your first jump, you go at least, like, a meter high. Your head, you have to duck your head so you don't hit it on the ceiling.
Yeah, but then now I hold a fist aloft into the air, and I jump as hard as I can trying to punch the ceiling.
Plaster falls down on you.
Yeah. All right. Now I say, it's a me, Brian-o, and then I do it again, and I keep punching the ceiling. Each time, making
and there's
the
a
sound
hole.
Effect.
And some guy looks over from a typewriter down at you.
Okay.
Can I help you?
All right. Well, hey, super Nazi. Why don't you just kill everybody so we can walk on out of here? You're so proud of your new powers. Why don't you just kill them all?
Time out. Hey, you know what? I've been meaning to bring this up for a while about your use of the N word. That's our word. You don't get to use it. You don't get to call me that. I am a person of accelerated powers.
When you say R word,
it's a word. A word. Also, Bryce, why is your ghost here? Oh,
yeah. The door creaks
hard
open.
I. Don't use the hard I.
Door creaks open. Hey, guys, are you done with this room already?
Who's that? Who's there?
I'm Administrator Franklin Schmidt. Are you guys done here? Because like I need the room. I've got a conference with.
Ryan's already got the upgrades. We got to get out of here and find the research trip. Okay. We're late.
Yeah. All right. Later.
I reach over and I grab Justin and carry him cradled in my arms as if he is a delicate damsel in distress.
All right, let's walk out.
And I say, worry not. And then I try to run super fast, and not knowing whether my legs will make the sound or not, I make sure to go ba-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na as I'm running around with Justin.
Octung, octung, octung. The springs go in your legs. So you guys, you just walk out. You're out of the building. You're free and clear.
Well, I have to assume that's behind us now. Here, let's cradling.
We need to find two vehicles. We need to find two vehicles.
No, you don't need a vehicle.
In the middle of the desert, you got out of this facility, and it's like literally just like a doorway sticking out of like, you know, a small little hut almost. Like
okay, so there's no vehicles around?
Nope.
All right, we got to go in and find the garage because we got to get vehicles.
All right, so we turn around, we knock on the door.
Who is it?
Hey, it's us. We need transportation. We need to get in there.
Oh yeah, carpool level 3. Go ahead, go take your pick.
Great. All right, so we go down. What do we have to choose from?
Got a Hummer. You got a Volkswagen Bug. You've got a Mercedes.
All right, I jump in the Mercedes and say, "I'll race you up," and I take off and I leave Brian behind.
Okay, I chase him with my head down and my arms pumping like the T-1000. From the Terminator 2 movie.
I'm driving as fast as I can away from Brian.
I look at my arm and wish it to morph into a hook. Does it work? No.
No,
okay,
no,
not that power. Doesn't. All right, so I just keep rocking.
They changed your physical.
Justin's is fast. You're not that fast,
Brian. Okay. All right. I laugh at the hilarious jape Justin pulled off. Yet again, always something with this guy. And then I go back and I get in a Humvee and I start riding behind him. I try to follow his trail.
Justin, do you take any evasive maneuvers?
Am I out of the car? Am I out of the physical structure of the protectorate? Or
yeah, you're driving across the desert now.
We're driving across the desert. No, I'm just hauling ass as fast as I can toward LA.
I'm following.
Are you getting
his
away from Brian,
plume.
Or do you want to wait for him?
I'm trying to get away from Brian and his bugged ass Hitler Siri. Brian, Brian has sold out this cause.
I asked real quick. I'm a little bit bored on my drive, so I say, "Hey Adolf, tell me a joke."
Why does the chicken cross the road?
Oh, why is that, Adolf?
And he was arrested and taken away.
You always know what to say, Adolf. So I'm driving.
Let's watch some Charlie Chaplin. The Dictator, not my favorite.
All right. So is this where we end this chapter?
Well, I have a question. How does it make you feel that your friend abandoned you?
It's just, you know how it is. Little lover's quarrel. He plays run is? Away from me, calls me a Nazi. Ain't no big thing. I still haven't figured out all the cool powers I have. I turn to my right and I punch the headrest of the seat to my right. What happens?
Smashes, obliterates.
See? Smash.
A little bag of weed falls out too.
I look at the bag of weed and I just tuck it in my pocket because you never know.
Okay, so Justin's determined to get away from you, and you want to catch up with him. Do you still want to catch up with Justin?
We're inseparable. Night Attack is in a couple days. I got to catch up with him, otherwise we won't be able to do our episode.
Right in front of you is a CB radio.
Oh, yeah. All right. So I pick up the CB, and I say,
and next time on Journey Quest, we'll find out what Brian says to Justin. Can he bring him back? Will the two be reunited? Is Brian actually harboring the remnants of Hitler's brain in his own head?
Only one way to find out.
Spoiler, yeah. Yes, he is. What a kick. Yeah.
You don't know that.
Next time on Z Journey Quest.
Hey, I got
saw that one coming.
No, I most certainly did not.
Who saw that coming at the beginning? Not me either.
I got a pick, the likes of which you will not believe, my friends. Mm. I want to be clear. I'm going to use some harsh language. I don't mean it in a distasteful way. But I have found the best, worst thing on all of Netflix. Go right now and check out Galactica 1980. It's Battlestar Galactica 1980. Dude. Not the original 1970s Battlestar Galactica, where it's pretty much the same story as the reboot. In 1980, they find Earth, but decide to go on some weird-ass, nonsensical time-traveling adventures that I can't imagine was secretly just so that they could have an excuse to spend a lot less money on set design and special effects. But these guys drive around on kooky bikes that fly sometimes, but every time they fly, they're like, oh, we shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have flown our space bikes again. And they feel real bad. And it's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. And I want to call it bad. But when I say bad, what I mean is it's very elementary. It's very of its time. It's very low budget. They're plowing through the fundamentals of storytelling. And yes, they definitely replay the same clip art over and over and over again to maximize the use out of it. They definitely use some old file footage. Like, you can see suddenly the film grain goes to like a horribly destroyed print because they needed to show some World War II fighter jets, and so they just, fighter planes attacking. It is what it is, but if you want something on to be noise in the background and you're of the right demographic where it's going to be a nostalgia bomb, I can't recommend it enough. It is so terabad. Just every cliche, every excuse you could think of. They even make a reference to Chips at some point. Like the two California Highway Patrol guys are trying to pull over the dudes who definitely are not Apollo and Starbuck, because they didn't even come back for this. But they look just like Apollo and Starbuck. And then and instead they fly off, and then the guy turns to the other, he's like, how come that never happens to those other guys on TV?
Oh my god.
It's great.
Yeah, apparently this on DVD, it was released on DVD in 2007 and marketed as the original final season of the Battlestar Galactica.
That's amazing. It's really
something. It's from a different time in television, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
A very, very different time in
television. And it's Glenn A. Larson at his Glenn A. Larsonist bit, you know, where I could totally see him just dictating the whole script while speed walking high on cocaine, I assume, which is all of that is defamatory. I made that up.
Yeah. He definitely just regular walks.
Yeah, he doesn't speed walk.
Do you know what the definition of speed walking is?
What is it?
That at no point are both feet off the ground.
Oh, that's right, because that's when you're running. So as long as one foot...
is at some point, both feet are off the ground, but speed walking...
That was on Malcolm in the Middle.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, Brian Cranston, the father, takes up speed walking, but there's this other guy who's like the speed walking star. Everybody else loves this guy. And he's watching video footage of him, and he sees like both of his feet leave the ground. He's like,
I got him. Did you ever see, I want to say it was like an Australian company that did a promo for Malcolm in the Middle. They got the back catalog in syndication, but they took all these out of context moments of Brian Cranston and they cut together the promo as if he's the star. And it's actually just Breaking Bad. Like it's him saying, hey, we're gonna cook, and it cuts to him in his underwear as the dad and all that stuff, and it's just like, oh, it's we're in some real trouble now, and cars crash and all that stuff. It's amazing.
That was a great show. That's such a great show. All right,
it's funny because he's got the new movie coming out with James Franco, and it's like you kind of see a little like rumbling of like, oh wow, I don't know how I'll like him in a comedy. It's like, man, you know him from a comedy.
Yeah. Justin, you have a pick?
Yeah. Thanksgiving evening with the family, we watched a little film called Hell or High Water. It is really, really good. Chris Pine and Jeff Bridges, right? It is a little Western drama in the outskirts of Texas, wherein a couple brothers are robbing banks and the Texas Rangers that are off to catch him. It has a very simple premise. It is a movie that is smarter than it initially appears to be. And I kind of stayed away from it initially because a lot of the reviews I read said it had this kind of like political message, and it certainly kind of does, but very much in the best, in all of my favorite crime fiction, you don't necessarily need to subscribe to the political worldview of the people that are doing the thing that you, otherwise shouldn't, but it just needs to be compelling and interesting. And this movie is kind of always that. So, go ahead and check it out. Hell or High Water.
Groovy. So I have, one, I just want to, re-up my pick I made before about, Arthur C. Clarke, The Collected Stories. I've been listening to that nonstop every time I get a little bit of downtime, and just thoroughly enjoying them because they're told and the sequence in which he wrote these stories. And so the evolution of that, I think, is an audible thing. It's great. Like whenever I'm in my bedroom and I'm just willing to chill out, I'll just, play some, listen to a short story or two from there. And I think his short stories are fantastic. He was so gifted at that. So that, but then I got a book. I got an actual book, a physical book, gentlemen. I know people hear us talk about audible books and all that, and they're like, what a bunch of illiterates. All right. I'm going to dispel that right now with an actual print book.
Go on.
Okay. Oh, damn. The pop-up books are back.
I got the Lego pop-up book, another book by my pop-up master paper engineer hero, Matthew Reinhardt. All right. And let me show you here. I'm going to show for our listeners here just to get an idea. You know, like he's a master of doing like these multi-purpose sort of like you open it up and like, hey, look, there's cool. It's a car, right? But he likes to do things where you do, well, let's lift this tab up. Oh, wait. Now it transforms into a boat, right?
Holy crap.
And then I'll pull this other tab. This is great for a podcast you're listening to. I pull this and boom,
transforms into a giant dinosaur robot.
Wow. Yeah. So like I've got his Transformers book, which he did, which is amazing. You've got some really, his pop-ups, they just explode off the page. Like, oh, look, hey, it's a cool castle. Oh, wait, there's another tab here. I'm going to pull this. I wonder what could happen if I pull that. Boom, space scene. So he's got a lot of really cool ones. There's a little thing in here, like a little spin this wheel and create your own little Lego dude. And then I'm going to get to the last pop-up on the page, or last one in here. You ready for this?
Oh, my God. It's a 2.5 foot tall, 3 foot tall structure pops out of this freaking book. That's amazing.
Physically impossible, but it does. So I'm going to pull this tab here like, oh, how do I get to these people on top of this Lego tower? I would need a crane. Beep, beep,
beep, beep, beep, beep. Oh, my God. There's a crane.
Wow.
I'm literally buying this right now while we're live on the air.
I mean, it is an amazing, like this, the way this thing is constructed, how it pops up. He's taken paper engineering to a whole new height. Absolutely clever. Absolutely brilliant. So
that's amazing.
Wow. Pretty crazy. And it's insane that it's as cheap as $18.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like I would just with that demo, if it were twice the price, I would not blink at it.
Yeah. So a lot of bunch of fun facts in there about Lego and different sort of Lego worlds and stuff.
He's got a Frozen pop-up book too? All right, I'm going to have to get all these.
What was that, Brian?
You're going to grab the Frozen one? Well, I've got... Okay, so now all of a sudden... All right,
the Frozen pop-up book?
I'm getting three. I'm going to get one for each of my girls. Hawkeye pop-ups. Frozen pop-ups. All right, I'm going to buy all these.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.